Military spokesman Yahya Sari said it was another response to the Saudi-led aggression against Yemen. The military spokesman warned Saudis and foreign companies operating in the kingdom to stay away from vital installations, as he pledged that Yemeni fighters will keep up such retaliatory operations. The new Quds II cruise missile must have flown over 400 miles to reach its target. The latest missile strike once again underscores Ansarullah's fast improving capabilities to hit Saudi targets with high precision.
This strike on Aramco's site should certainly let the Saudi kingdom know that this is not a war it can win. It has shown, it has attempted for years to defeat the Yemeni people and has not succeeded, and they're only getting stronger.
Ansarullah's arsenal of new weapons, including projectiles and drones, has become a major headache for the Saudis nearly 6 years after they began the war to defeat the popular forces. The Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the de facto ruler of the kingdom and the architect of the war, has been under pressure to find a way to end the failing, protracted military campaign. None of the strategic goals of the invasion have been fulfilled after all these years. But bin Salman's close ties with the U.S. President Donald Trump, mainly based on huge American arms sales, have allowed him to keep the war going. Will the Saudi prince take the increasing power of Yemeni forces seriously and change direction? The Saudi-led war in Yemen began in March 2015. It will be the sixth anniversary of the war in just a few months. The war in Yemen has been described by many as a forgotten war. The onslaught has been rarely covered by mainstream media. Even when Saudi airstrikes hit markets, weddings, schools, or hospitals, killing large numbers of civilians, the war got little attention in Western news channels. The situation has long been the world's worst humanitarian disaster. As the Yemenis suffered, the business-minded president of the United States took the opportunity to seal massive arms deals with the Saudis. The kingdom has been free to buy anything from America, from fighter jets to command and control system and advanced battle tanks and warships. The U.S. is a partner in this aggression. The U.S. military support for the Saudis and their Emirati allies also includes mid-air refueling, providing intelligence and logistics. The incumbent U.S. president will probably leave the White House soon. How will his successor Joe Biden act on Yemen? Saudi Arabia has a very powerful lobby in Washington, and the kingdom's petrodollars have proven irresistible to American politicians and decision-makers for many decades.
It's unlikely there'll be any change. The U.S. is always happy to foment and encourage a disruption and disorder and chaos anywhere in the Middle East. And because Saudi Arabia is such a large buyer of U.S. weaponry, the United States government under Biden or Trump or anybody else will not want to see those profits diminish.
Biden faces tough choices over Yemen and his ties with the regime of Saudi Arabia, as he will probably need to make very important decisions soon.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
A new survey results reveal that 68% of Americans want members of the U.S. Senate to reject any corporate-linked nominees proposed by the incoming president. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jessica Corbett Ryder. This article is published under the heading, New poll shows 68% of Americans want senators to block any corporate Biden nominees. Here's the details of this article. Bolstering calls for Joe Biden to keep business insiders and industry lobbyists out of his cabinet, new survey results reveal that 68% of Americans want members of the U.S. Senate to reject any corporate-linked nominees proposed by the incoming president. The Data for Progress poll, sponsored by Demand Progress and first reported on Tuesday, November 24th by the Daily Poster, found that a majority of Democrats, Republicans, and independents across all documented demographics agree about how the Senate should respond to such nominees. The majority of likely voters surveyed believe that if Biden tries to install corporate executives and lobbyists in top positions of his administration, senators should vote against confirming them and urge the president-elect to instead put forth nominees who have worked to forward the interests of everyday Americans. The polling conducted after Election Day in November has a margin of error of plus or minus 3 percentage points. The results come as Biden continues to fill out his administration, with the president-elect having announced key appointments and cabinet nominees in recent days. Those selections have been met with mixed responses from progressives and others, calling on Biden to forego a corporate cabinet in favor of picking, in the words of Demand Progress Executive Director David Siegel recently, people dedicated to working in service of the general welfare. As the Daily Poster noted, along with pushing Biden to break with the Clinton and Obama administration tradition of installing corporate allies in key governmental positions, Demand Progress and the Revolving Door Project are poll-testing potential nominees with descriptions of their background to gauge potential public support and opposition for a Biden cabinet. For example, the new survey explains that Larry Fink is the CEO of BlackRock, a financial firm which is the largest asset manager and the largest investor in the fossil fuel industry in the world. Before asking whether respondents would support Biden appointing him to a cabinet post, 66% of those polled said they would somewhat or strongly oppose Fink. The American Prospect reported on Tuesday, November 24th, that Biden, this, also of BlackRock, is under a strong consideration to head Biden's National Economic Council. Half of survey respondents said they oppose these. The survey results were similar for Mark Gitenstein, a corporate lobbyist who has pushed to undo regulations at the behest of large agribusinesses, insurance companies, Wall Street, and defense contractors, as well as Tony James, Steve Ricchetti, and Rhode Island Governor Gina Raimondo. All four of them are not only opposed by a majority of voters, but also targets of the No Corporate Cabinet campaign. launched last week by Demand Progress, the Revolving Door Project, and other partner groups, the initiative has persons of interest webpage about potential appointees whom Biden should avoid, according to organizers. The page features Fink, James Dis, Ricchetti, Raimondo, former Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz, Jason Bordoff, Heather Zichal, and Bruce Reed. The Daily Poster highlighted the corporate ties and progressive critics of some selections Biden has already announced. On Monday, November 23rd, Biden announced that he has chosen Tony Blinken to serve as Secretary of State. Blinken found West Exit Advisors, a secretive business consultancy that has worked with defense contractors. Avril Haines, a former West Exit principal, will serve as Biden's Director of National Intelligence. Biden is also reportedly considering nominating West Exit co-founder Michael Flourney to serve as Secretary of Defense, as well as two corporate lawyers, Sally Yates and Karen Dunn, to serve as Attorney General and the head of the Justice Department Antitrust Division, respectively. Biden did appease some progressives with the nomination of former Federal Reserve Chairman Janet Yellen to serve as his Treasury Secretary. Yellen would be a rare Treasury Secretary who didn't come straight from Wall Street, and she has supported deficit spending and tougher banking regulations, though she has also echoed some of the austerity rhetoric of groups aiming to cut Social Security and Medicare. In a Data for Progress survey, a majority of respondents said they somewhat or strongly support Biden appointing Yellen to a cabinet position and a Senate confirming her. While the polling shows a bipartisan desire for lawmakers to block Biden for putting together a corporate cabinet, control of the Senate remains uncertain. If Democrats were to win a pair of January runoff races in Georgia, the party would have 50 seats in the upper chamber, and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris could break tie votes.
Hi everyone, this is John. You are with me for another episode of our weekly show, The Subcontinent. Our program focuses on few of the most critical, sensitive, and important issues in the subcontinent, which is a region which hosts almost 25% of the global population. So let's dive into our segment, break down issues, take expert opinion, and see what people say.
In this edition of the subcontinent, we shall look into India's railway privatization. Also, we will explore the pros and cons of this bumpy road.
India's government is moving ahead with its privatization initiative in many spheres. Now, it is time for the Indian Railways. The Indian Railways is the third largest railway network in the world by size, with a route length of about 70,000 kilometers. It has always been the network that connects India, but opening it to private investors may make it less available for most of the people.
The privatization of Indian railways has been recommended for many decades. But recently, the government officially started the process to allow private firms to operate passenger trains on its network via 151 new trains. This marks the beginning of private sector participation in passenger train operations. Last year, the government decided that the Indian Railways will restructure all its 7 production units and associated workshops, including like ICF Perambur, RCF Kapurthula, Modern Coach Factory and Raebareli, into a cooperation called Indian Railways Roll Stocking Company. The railways is not the only sector Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government is opening to the corporates. The government has already invited the private firms to other sectors like coal mines, banks, defence, oil, insurance, electricity, telecom, space and atomic energy.
They are selling off the public sector, big factories and institutions. Even the railways are being privatised. One train has been sold. And the people working on that train have to work for 18 hours of the day. They have fallen sick. This is the future that they are showing.
The process has its own merits and demerits, as experts say the measure is a clash between the consequences of the need for modernization versus social obligations.
A few weeks ago, in early July 2020, the Railway Ministry announced that 151 trains in 109 pair of routes will be operated by private sectors with a 30,000 crore rupees investment. There are ideas and people both in favor and against the plan. Some see privatization as the way forward, and some mention the unfavorable outcomes that may follow the move.
Although the initial phase of the privatization would cover a small part of the entire railway network, liberalizing the entry of new operators in the public transport may be the path for improving services and facilitating growth of the sector. Those in favor of the project believe fares in private trains will be competitive, and the introduction of private players would eventually increase the number of trains, ensuring high availability on demand and punctuality. The proponents argue that privatization means higher quality of services, which can help India renovate its fleet and accommodate the latest technology in railways, coaches, safety and travelling experience. They say privatization will lead to better infrastructure, which in turn would lead to improved safety, reduction in travel time and etc. Indian railway services are marred by issues like lack of punctuality, mismanagement in the form of stinking washrooms, lack of water supply and dirty platforms. Privatization may solve these issues, as the move would foster competition and hence lead to overall betterment in the quality of services. Thereby, it may help Indian Railways to become a world-class network, but some believe it may simply backfire.
The proponents of privatization say that it creates jobs and fosters modernization. But those on the other side argue that only the driver and guard will be railway employees. All other employees will be part of the private company who has won the contract to operate the train. The private companies are free to procure train and locomotives from any source of their choice. This may be a threat to national production and self-reliance.
Opponents of India's privatization of railways speak of numerous limitations for the project, including increased fares and disconnecting some less trodden parts of the country. Not unexpectedly, private enterprise runs on profit, and the easiest way to profit from their investment may be to hike fares. The huge increase in the ticket fare would render the service beyond the reach of lower-income groups and destroy the initial purpose of the railways, which is meant to serve the entire population irrespective of the level of income. An advantage of government-owned railways is that it provides nationwide connectivity to bring regional development. This would not continue with privatization because routes which are less popular, hence less profitable, may be neglected. This can have a negative impact on connectivity. Some parts of the country, including regions with rugged terrain and low population density, like Himalayan states and northeastern states, may become virtually inaccessible. Privatization may drop them out of the process of development.
Another concern about the plan is the confusion on land titles and land use as the properties are dated. The railways company says that there is no change required in the regulations to carry out the project, but local authorities in many places do not agree to it. Most of the stations are located in the crowded and old parts of the cities, away from the new infrastructure. To make the project commercially viable, a holistic plan for the development of the entire catchment area is required, instead of just the standalone station plan. According to the data maintained by the World Bank, in 2018, India had 68,443 kilometers of route of railways. It is among the four largest rail networks in the world, along with the United States, China, and Russia. Although every kilometer of track in India covers geographical area much less than Germany, Russia, China, or Canada, indicating scope for expansion.
If the privatization of Asia's oldest railway is implemented as planned, modern trains will be added to the network, which needs heavy investment in rolling stock like coaches and engines. Moreover, there is the cost of operations, which includes electricity, manpower, and all other equipment. Such a scenario means all the facilities should be upgraded with better onboard services and faster trains. Who's going to pay this huge modernization expense? The railways company, private investors, or people? The plan enables investors to make money either by monetizing land and airspace by setting up shops, kiosks, advertisement hoardings, parking lots, offices, and residential properties. The sector is already in decline and losing business to other modes like air and road. Operating passenger trains is a loss-making business for Indian Railways. It recovers only around 57% of the cost through tickets on an average. The rest is cross-subsidized through earnings from its freight operations.
All right, gentlemen, our team has collected a few media coverages in this regard, which we would really appreciate if you could take a look. So let's just get to the media and then we can come back to the question of the session. Please stay with us.
Asia's oldest rail network will invite applications for modernizing stations across the country every month. But for that, Indian Railways will have to overcome delays, streamline approvals, and cut red tape, things that derailed the effort earlier. But drawing interest from the private sector for station upgrade has been harder than thought, as delays and stringent conditions made it unviable. Envisioned in 2004 to 2005, the project failed to take off. Modi renewed it in 2016 with a plan to redevelop 400 stations. Immediately after the announcement, as usual, the Bucks started welcoming the decision of the government. Unfortunately, in our country, the mainstream of the media, instead of speaking the truth without fear, has been reduced to being drum beaters of the present government. The government continue its loyalty to the interests of the corporate sector, and the common people's interests are always buried. It is estimated that almost 70% of freight trains, which now jostle for space with passenger trains on the overcrowded Indian railway network, will shift to the two upcoming dedicated freight corridors from December 2021. This will free up a lot of capacity to introduce more passenger trains with better services and higher speeds.
Now, for more analysis, let me welcome our guest to the show, Mr. Mohan Guruswamy, the chairman of Center for Policy Alternatives and a former advisor to the Indian Finance Minister, Yashwant Sinha. We also have with us Mr. Raghunandan, who is with the Delhi Science Forum, a non-profit think tank. Let's start with Mr. Guruswamy. Mr. Guruswamy, are we expecting a privatization of the Indian Railways?
Such a thing, let me tell you, is practically impossible. For a start, it's the biggest railway system in the world. It's got over 1.2 million employees. And it runs at a loss. It's hugely subsidized. Privatization would imply that somebody has to come and buy it, and it has to run profitably. it won't happen because a lot of the economy rides on the cheap movement of people from place to place. For instance, migrant labor. They move from, millions move every year from different parts of India to work in the big cities, and they go back in the off-season. They travel on the subsidized railway. Even passengers who and commercial travelers who travel use the subsidized benefit. The cost of passengers is subsidized by the freight. Railway freight is now becoming very expensive. Now the problem with having the existing system is the people who are willing to spend lots of money for the luxury of train travel are unable to do so because the railways are just not able to maintain high-class railway travel because they're subsidizing the poorer passengers. Here what is going to happen for the first time is that the coaches are going to be owned, the stock is going to be owned by private parties, and they're going to operate it on the railway system, pay the railways for use of track, pay the railways for use of signaling, pay the railways for use of railway platforms and all that. But this does not mean that all trains, all passenger trains will be privatized. It's impossible, cannot happen, and nobody would want to invest money in something which is loss-making. And private railways, besides their experience, has not been good anywhere in the world. In the US, you hardly have any private railway systems, and the ones which function, barely function. In Britain, it has been a huge failure after Margaret Thatcher privatized them. So it won't happen in India. I don't think it can happen in India, nor will it happen in India.
So, Mr. Raghunandan, what do you think?
Well, the privatization is taking place in bits and pieces. There is privatization of 400 main railway stations compared to thousands of railway stations in the country. There is privatization of a few selected routes, premium routes, but which are medium length routes. They are being handed over to private players. And there is privatization of some services like catering, food services on trains. So, broadly speaking, I agree that this is not privatization of the railways in the sense it is understood in Europe or the UK, for example. The entire railways are not being privatized, but there are parts of the railways, bits of it, which are being privatized.
Okay, staying with you, Mr. Raghunandan. So, who will benefit from all of this?
The way it is structured now, the only benefits will be the private concessionaires who will be given these different sectors or railway stations or whatever it is to run. They will benefit. The passengers as a whole, I don't see them benefiting because, number one, all the services, rail services, trains which are being privatized are premium services which cater to only a very small percentage of the population.
All right. So, Mr. Guruswamy, how would these plans have an impact on the ordinary Indians, the working class, the migrant workers?
They could benefit in the to the extent that, you know, there'll be more coaches available for them, for their regular trains, that is for a start. And the other thing is that, you know, already right now you have coaches reserved for upper classes. And it's actually quite sad to see miserable conditions in the lower class and fairly comfortable travel in the upper class. So you won't have that. You won't have a class system, probably in the future.
All right, Mr. Raghunandan. Mr. Guruswamy said that there are miserable conditions for the poor and there's a class difference, a clear class difference that we see. Do you agree?
Yeah. So the argument you were giving that since these privatized trains will cater to the higher paying passengers, that will vacate a certain number of seats which will then be available to the lower classes, doesn't apply. Because what they are going to do is the already premium services of the railways are going to be privatized, with a few add-on luxuries such as onboard Wi-Fi or something like that, for which passengers will be charged a little even more than the premium prices they are paying now. So the seats vacated will not filter down to the lower classes at all, because the lower classes travel on very different trains and in very different coaches.
Mr. Raghunandan, could you please elaborate more on that?
Yeah. 90% of railway passengers in India travel by what is called second class or lower categories, which are non-air conditioned, not particularly comfortable trains. They are meant for the average traveler. 90% of India, especially including the poor and the lower middle class and the working class, travel by these trains and these coaches. There are trains which are intercity trains, trains which connect different major cities with the capital and so on, which are completely air conditioned even now. And obviously the poorer classes will not travel by those trains. Now, what are being privatized now in services are fully air conditioned trains only. These are the ones being privatized because this is only where the private concessionaires can make profit. So the average user of the Indian railways will remain untouched. In that sense, I think the poorer classes will lose because they will have less priority from the government. And of course, they have no role to play as far as the private sector is concerned, because private sector will not make any money from these people.
All right, gentlemen, our team has collected a few media coverages in this regard, which we would really appreciate if you could take a look. So let's just get to the media and then we can come back to the question of the session. Please stay with us.
Several committees have gone into the expansion and the modernization of Indian railways. In 2015, the expert panel chaired by Bibek Debroy, constituted by the Ministry of Railways a year earlier, recommended that the way forward for the railways was liberalization and not privatization in order to allow entry of new operators, to encourage growth and improve services. It also made it clear that a regulatory mechanism was a prerequisite to promote healthy competition and protect the interests of all stakeholders. The way privatization will affect the masses is not a question that we have to concern ourselves, well, at least in the long run. It is true that the decision is reflective of the government's effort to cut its losses given the abhorrent financial discredit suffered on account of the pandemic. As far as investment opportunities are concerned, there is value for investing these companies, as is well substantiated by their large market cap and stable financials. After missing several completion targets in the past, the Dedicated Freight Corridor Corporation of India Limited has now been given a fresh timeline ending June 2022, which appears to be a Herculean task given its snail's pace of the past. Though progress in the Dedicated Freight Corridors project is abysmally slow, the completion of the Dedicated Goods Corridor is crucial for the success of the part privatization of passenger and freight services. It is like when private banks were set up in India. So many private players came in the banking sector, but that didn't lead SBI to shut. Private investment will bring in newer technologies. It will create competition in the railway sector. Competition will increase efficiency and reduce fare in the long run, Niti Aayog CEO Amitabh Kant said. The move is being criticized by many political associations as they term it an anti-poor move. There are chances, but as for now, these trains are not going to affect the poor, as the railways will still be running 95% of total trains once these private trains start operation in full swing. However, if the government decides to go for further privatization of the sector, then it may create problems for the commoners.
All right, gentlemen, welcome back. Let's dive straight in. So, Mr. Guruswamy, recalling back what Mr. Raghunandan said, that the average person will not even be touched by the benefits that will ensue. So, can having more players involved help improve the system, or will it be detrimental?
Well, nobody will come into the low-cost travel segment. So that is where the mass volume is, and that's where 95% of the traffic is. This is a very niche segment at the top. Because, you know, there are limits to how many airports you can have, how much of air travel you can have. So this is very niche, and this is an experiment. Let's see how it goes. One or two routes they're going to try, one or two trains they're going to try. And let's see how it works. But nobody can afford to run trains at the cost Indian Railways does. That is the point I'm making.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us and for the wonderful conversation. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. And let's hope all of these end up to the benefit of the Indian nation and not only for the rich. Now we have some social media opinions and then we can conclude. Thank you.
The account of the National Students' Union of India believes that as the backbone of the country's economy, privatization of railways will have a considerable effect on the whole economy. Surav Prasad also believes that privatization is not necessary, especially when the government-owned system is not based on gaining profit, in which he sees it as an advantage of this model. The official account of the youth wing of Indian National Congress strongly criticizes the government for leaving young railway apprentices without jobs by privatizing the sector. ANI quoted from the Railway Board Chairman Vinod Kumar Yadav as saying that the private trains will start servicing by April 2023. On the other hand, Jairam Ramesh believes that this policy will not succeed as it has not worked in any other country.
And that was our episode covering the issue of Indian railway privatization. We'll meet next week.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Are really cute and interesting animals. They are one of the most intelligent types of animals on Earth. Elephants are emotional animals. Feelings like sympathy and altruism are visibly seen among them. How However, these cute, clever animals have big ivories, which have made them exposed to the danger of extinction. The biggest enemies of elephants are humans, and this animosity is due to the fact that humans are after the elephant's ivory. It's a shame, of course. Well, today I'm going to visit a place in northern Iran, to the Ivory Museum of Ramsar. About 90 years ago, a building under the area of 578 square meters was built in the city of Ramsar in Mazandaran province. This magnificent structure has placed a unique museum inside. The Ivory Museum of Iran is the first specialized ivory museum in the West Asia region. This museum displays a very rare collection of artworks, including ivory carvings and fine art on ivory, which is very attractive. This museum includes 300 valuable artworks, which have been created by the artists of the East and Southeast Asia, as well as parts of Africa. Among the distinguished artworks showcased in this museum, mention can be made of different types of statues and decorative artifacts. I am now standing by the building of Ramsar Ivory Museum. This two-story building is white in color and looks really gorgeous. And the area around the building is a green space, which is so pleasant. Well, let's enter this really pretty building. Ivory Museum of Ramsar consists of different sections, including the Chamber of Human Statues, the Chamber of Arms, the Chamber of Non-Human Statues, the Chamber of Elephants, and the Chamber of Decorative Objects. First of all, I'm going to visit the Chamber of Non-Human Statues. Stay with me. I am now in front of a very big window showcase, and regrettably, the first thing seen in this showcase is the huge foot of an elephant. Oh, I'd better skip this showcase. It makes me depressed. Okay, behind this showcase, there are small, delicate statues of different animals, all made of elephant ivory, including panther, crocodile, and even a tiny rat. Here's the Chamber of Human Statues. Wish you were here to see these delicate statues of men and women in here. Here there are statues of two East Asian men who are playing chess. Oh, the details of these statues are really unbelievable. Even the hair strands of these statues are delicately made. Well, I am now in the Chamber of Arms. Here there are daggers, fully made of ivory. And here, there are swords with the ivory-made hilt. Oh, and how cute! Here, there are plenty of sticks, which have ivory decorations. I don't know since when sticks became known as arms. I am now in the chamber of decorative objects of the Ivory Museum. Just across from me, there is a beautiful ship with incredible details. Its beauty is indescribable. You have to come here to see all these beauties and delicacies. Oh, look at here! It's a wooden folding screen with frames which have lots of beautiful pictures on them made of ivory. What beautiful flowers! These flowers look so real that you feel like you want to pick them each. Well, it's as if all the art and beauty created by the innovative fingers of humans have been gathered here. However, we should not forget that all these beauties have been at the cost of the lives of thousands of elephants. Was it really worth it? I suppose not. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Around the world with reporters.
A human tide, rarely seen, flooded in the streets of Paris and all over France in a freedom march against a new security law. The massive protest is held against President Macron's government that is pushing a new bill that restricts the ability to film police. Human rights associations and media are unanimous. This law would allow police brutality to go undiscovered and unpunished.
There's a huge popular opposition against this law. Even the Human Rights Commission of the United Nations and other international bodies criticize it. A social majority in this country refuses the implementation of this law. Since a long time, they alert the government on police brutality and violence against women. Violence against women during the lockdown is exploding, and the government remains inactive and guilty.
Two major events this week plead in favor of the protesters and of the importance of video footage to denounce police violence. First, French police dismantled a migrant camp in central Paris. The French government ordered an internal police investigation after police officers were filmed tossing migrants out of tents and intentionally tripping one while evacuating a protest camp.
It is important to film this kind of situations because it's part of freedom of expression. Filming with our phones is almost the only way of publishing this kind of violence against migrants, people from the suburb, against everybody.
And then a second video showed the violent arrest of a black music producer in Paris. Three police officers repeatedly punched and hit him during 20 minutes. The man told that the officers made racist insults.
Thanks to the images showing the beating by a kind of private militia attacking a music producer, the truth has come out. Without this video footage from a surveillance camera, The man would be in prison, accused for using violence against the police. That shows the importance of having a counter-power in this country.
Under a huge pressure, Interior Minister Darmanin announced disciplinary proceedings as soon as possible, but that might be too little, too late. In the meantime, the protest is going on.
A large majority in the French parliament voted in favor of the security law, but the Senate still has to approve it. Right-wing senators, a majority in the Senate, declared they will rewrite the law because it is unconstitutional. Chris Denhant, Paris.
Tens of thousands of Sudanese have bid farewell to their last democratically elected prime minister, who died of COVID-19-related complications at 84. According to the National Umma Party, which she led until his death, Sadiq al-Mahdi died in hospital in the United Arab Emirates, where he was receiving treatment after becoming infected with the novel coronavirus in October.
I think the loss of the Sadiq al-Mahdi, the Umma Party leader, and the Sudanese, the most intellectual person in the Sudanese political process, is so great loss. This it will be reflecting on all and hold the political process.
Imam Sadiq is the greatest one in the Sudan, and this is era need him. Why? Because according to the government,
Al-Mahdi served as a prime minister in the mid 60s and again in the mid 80s before he was overthrown in a coup of 1989. Which led to rise power of President Omar al-Bashir. After being forced out of office, al-Mahdi remained a leading politician in Sudan. In a statement, Sudan Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok described him as one of the most important figures of thought, politics, literature, and wisdom in the country. Meanwhile, senior National Umma Party said that the party will continue to follow the anti-Israel policies taken by the late Sadiq al-Mahdi.
We have our own doctrine based on the Islamic ethics. We are against the normalization. If the needs arise, not Al-Burhan, neither Hamdok will decide on behalf of the Sudanese people. The elected, the coming elected parliament will decide on the behalf of the Sudanese nation.
I think this constitution will go in the same road of the leader Sadiq al-Mahdi. In the normalization, again is the normalization or any establishment of the relationship between the Sudan and Israel.
Al-Mahdi was a well-known Sudanese political figure who played an important role in public affairs and wrote several books addressing the situation in Sudan.
For more than 60 decades, Sadiq al-Mahdi was icon of democracy, Islamic thought, and a strong opponent of imperialism in Sudan and abroad. Muhammad Fazari from Khartoum, Twin City of Omdurman.
p.m. local time on Friday, in a countryside area east of Tehran, a truck loaded with explosives blew up to intercept car carrying top Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Eyewitnesses say five or six gunmen then rushed from a nearby vehicle and opened fire on his car. Fakhrizadeh was seriously injured and taken to hospital, but medics were unable to save his life. The incident immediately sent its shockwaves across Iran and beyond, with Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif calling the attack an act of terror and linking it to Israel. Inside Iran, the assassination comes as a shock. Less than 24 hours after the incident, people from all walks of life gathered outside the Iranian parliament to condemn the assassination, which they view as grave as the U.S.'s assassination of top IRGC commander Qasem Soleimani in January.
What happened to our nuclear scientist was carried out by the same terrorists who killed Qasem Soleimani. Like Mr. Soleimani, Fakhrizadeh offered many services to our nation.
If we back down on this terrorist act, the U.S. and Israel will become more insolent towards us. We have gathered here to urge the government and lawmakers to take a tough stance towards the perpetrators to avoid further such incidents.
Fakhrizadeh served as the head of the Research and Innovation Organization of the Defense Ministry. Iranian officials say he had a long history in defense innovations and had made key efforts to promote Iran's nuclear energy program.
Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
This had made him the number one target of Israel's intelligence services, which have a track record of targeted killings of Iranian nuclear scientists nearly a decade ago.
Israel is not willing to see Iran's advancement in science and technology. It killed four other Iranian nuclear scientists, and now it assassinated Mr. Fakhrizadeh. But Israel should know that it cannot stop Iran's peaceful nuclear program, because those martyrs have trained numerous young scientists who will take the lead in this field.
Observers say the assassination of the Iranian scientist comes as part of Israel's attempts to disrupt Iran's nuclear energy program, which Tel Aviv accuses of having military dimensions. Iran has time and again dismissed such allegations and signed the 2015 nuclear deal with the world powers as a sign of goodwill.
Fakhrizadeh now becomes the fifth Iranian nuclear scientist who was eliminated in a terror attack. While all indications attest to an Israeli involvement, Iranians here demand that the government take a harsh revenge. This, they say, would reduce the chances of more Iranian scientists becoming an easy target for terrorists. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
After the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in August 2019, all electoral processes in the region were suspended and Kashmir came under the direct control of New Delhi. Also, the role of major pro-India political parties in Kashmir was belittled after New Delhi detained all pro-India politicians. The absence of people's political participation created a void in Kashmir's political sphere and raised many questions on New Delhi's claims of normalcy in the region. And to break the ice, amid tough security measures, New Delhi is holding local elections in 8 phases, ending on December 19th. A large number of voters has braved cold weather to vote, and each of them has their own reasons.
Our educated youth are doing menial jobs. We have problems like improper roads and lack of electricity. Who will take up our issues to higher-ups? That's why we voted for our trusted candidate.
Election boycott calls in past by the pro-independence camp of Kashmir were highly supported by the people of Kashmir. But this time they say they want to fight for equality and justice via elections.
We are seeking respect since we are treated as second-class citizens. The country's progress hardly reaches us. By casting our vote, we tell the champions of democracy to do justice. Earlier, our election boycott was an excuse for them. Now we will give them no excuse. We want equal rights and treatment.
While voters have their own reasons to cast ballots, candidates have their aims too.
I can't promise my people jobs and land rights because with Article 370 everything is gone. My goal is to safeguard my people against the plots of people with anti-Muslim agendas. I believe in peace and tranquility and I want to work for secularism in my bloc.
The main contesting parties in this local election are Bharatiya Janata Party, Indian National Congress and Alliance of Local Political Parties.
Amid heightened security, the elections in Indian-administered Kashmir are being portrayed by many as a step towards normalcy and peace in the region. However, experts say such electoral processes have hardly helped Kashmir in the past, adding long-lasting peace is only possible when the issue gets permanently resolved between India and Pakistan. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Despite the apparent demise of the Trump era, it is clear that the far-right movement in the West is still alive and well. White supremacy, racism and xenophobia are problems in every EU country.
But this is the end! It's the end! Enough's enough!
Coordinated by the European Commission Brussels, religious leaders from all of the main faiths have just taken part in a video conference.
Reports of anti-Semitic and anti-Muslim attacks are now almost part of everyday life in our beloved Europe.
The leaders say the answer is to show more unity and greater mutual respect.
I want to say that if somebody hurts a Muslim sister, a Jewish brother, they are hurting me.
The European Union's much-criticized asylum policy also came under the spotlight during the event.
Europe loses its soul if we continue to watch people drowning in the Mediterranean. That is why we support civil rescue missions.
Religious leaders insist the European Union must do more to ensure refugees play a positive and productive role in society. Experts agree.
There were mistakes in integration of the